morning, everyone. Please be seated. Justices Cherry and Douglas are recused from this case, so we're sitting as a five-judge panel, and I'm the presiding justice today, which is a real distinct pleasure in the new courtroom. You were here yesterday, the counsel at counsel table. We will not have the Nevada state song or the national anthem today or the Pledge of Allegiance. Let's get underway. The first case on calendar is Leonard versus State, case number 62800. Are counsel prepared? Do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
Please, 5 minutes.
Very well.
Thank you. May it please the court, Christopher Orm on behalf of Mr. Gregory Leonard, appellant. Mr. Leonard's death sentence should be overturned because there's no valid aggravating circumstances. There were two aggravating circumstances found by the jury in this case. One, the state on page 44 of their brief, the robbery, has agreed pursuant to the McConnell decision is no longer valid. That leaves one aggravating circumstance. They filed the notice of that aggravator on the day trial started. And this court has already decided this issue or the rule of law pursuant to this issue. Pursuant to Bennett, pursuant to Marshall, and also a recent decision, Nunnery in this case, this court has already established that you cannot file the notice late without good cause. They didn't present good cause. They didn't file a motion. In Bennett and Marshall, this court said it is mandatory. And some of the language from those cases make it so that this becomes, what I would argue, a very easy decision. The court said in Marshall, the language of the rule is plain and ambiguous. The time limit for filing a notice of intent was mandatory, and a late filing was permissible only for good cause. The court went on to state, we conclude that good cause under the rule was not predicated on a lack of prejudice to the defendant. That's very important here. Because
what about, though, had trial counsel objected and moved to strike, wouldn't the correct remedy then be to continue the trial so you could restart the trial date, and therefore, arguably, there was a strategic reason, if you will, for not having made that objection when everyone knew that he had been convicted of murder and that was the DA's intention of an aggravator? Follow the question?
I do. And Mr. Sheik answers that question from the witness stand at the evidentiary hearing. He said that everything in his affidavit was true and accurate. He had no tactical reason whatsoever for not filing a motion to strike this. So,
but what about legally? How would that have played out? Let's assume that trial counsel said, hey, wait a minute, there was no written notice and this violates SCR 250.
Yes.
What would have happened at that point?
The court would have had to look at good cause. They would have had to file a motion to
state. Let's say the state said, I don't have good cause. All I have is that we didn't do it on time, but they already know, and we move to continue this trial date for 15 days or 30 days to reset that clock. Why wouldn't that have worked?
Because then the district court judge would have been clearly ignoring clearly established law under Bennett and Marshall. And that
Bennett and Marshall weren't on the books. Bennett may have been, Marshall was not, but Bennett was a case in which the procedural posture was quite different. I don't think it articulated such an absolute rule as you're wringing from it.
I see it that it issued a bright line rule, and they would still have had to follow the law. As I look at the rule, it says, if we just analyze the rule that we have, and it is on page 5 of my reply brief, absolute good cause shown, the prosecuting attorney may not file a notice of intent to seek the death penalty or a notice of additional aggravating circumstance less than 15 days prior to trial set for the commencement of trial.
Right, so, prior to the date set for the commencement of trial. But the fact of the matter is that's a movable date.
Yes, that's correct. It is, if the prosecuting attorney desires to file either notice less than 15 days prior to trial, the prosecuting attorney must It's mandatory language. Must file a written notice seeking leave of the court to do so. They did not do that. So if we just look back at time, Justice Pickering, wouldn't the district court have said, you have failed to comply with the rule at all. You haven't even filed a motion, and it's mandatory. So I'm not sure how the district court judge could have done anything about that, because you just haven't followed the rule. And
so your position is that had this been asserted by trial counsel, that aggravator would have been counted out on that day of trial, and it was irreversible?
Correct.
Okay.
That's my position, that they had failed to file it. Now, if they had filed a motion and they had some kind of good cause, which I don't know what they could have done, because they knew about the prior murder December 7th of 1998. That's when Mr. Leonard was convicted on the other murder.
Who represented Mr. Leonard in the other case? Wasn't it the same office, same counsel?
Yes. But both in Bennett and in Marshall, this court made it clear that the idea of lack of prejudice does not establish good cause or circumvent good cause. So those cases seem exactly on point. It's the same philosophy. There's nothing different. And if I could compare it for a second to something. I have spent much of my career fighting time bar on writs of habeas corpus. There are times the state often says, you're time barred. And this court, I have seen numerous orders where the court has no difficulty telling a defendant, not of a murder, not particularly intelligent, not filing on time. And that's the end of their cause. When I see the language from this court in Bennett and Marshall, and this rule, it's very similar. There's time constraints. But this time it is the state that has time constraint. And this time I see in the state's answering brief, none of the sort of the conversation we're having today, in their brief on page 33, they spend a page and a half discussing this issue. Never do they mention Marshall. Never do they mention Bennett. But they cite this court to a 1985 case before the rule.
It's a pre-250 case.
That's right. And to me, that tells us the answer. They have no argument. And just as defendants are time-barred, today, the state is time-barred. They didn't follow the rules. They didn't even attempt to do what happened in Marshall and Bennett, where, at least in that case, the prosecutor complained, I was busy. I was very busy. When I realized I had not filed the notice, I filed it on that very day. At least there were excuses. Here there are none. And what I also see is the state coming to this argument.
Well, they're sort of making an excuse that everyone knew about it and it was a clerical matter. I mean, that's what I understand their argument to be.
Yes, and I also thought of a comparison to that last game. In State of Nevada versus Margaret Rubin and her appeal from post-conviction, in the original denial of her direct appeal in this court, the majority sent it back down and said she should be given post-conviction counsel. The state would know that she was going to file post-conviction brief. Attorney was appointed, did nothing for years. Then another attorney was appointed to me, and we won a new trial, this court, on direct appeal. Okay? The state was on notice that she was going to file a writ of habeas corpus. Now, if we incorporate that here, isn't that the same thing the state is trying to do? Oh, well, they knew about it. That's not the point. The rule doesn't say if all the parties knew. In fact, it says something very different. And both Marshall and Bennett said it's not acceptable. And there was language in those cases that I thought really had some strong teeth in it. And one of them says, this court requires accountability and diligence by the state when deciding what aggravators to pursue in the first instance. That's telling the state, you better file in a timely fashion. There'll be no excuses. If you have one, you better bring it in the form of a motion. They didn't do any of this. They're just asking for forgiveness. It's no different than the defendant saying, at the end of the jury trial, I said I was going to complain about my attorney not being effective, so then the state knew that I was going to file a writ. That wouldn't work in this court.
So you're saying that it's not possible to waive that requirement because it's clear to me, at least reading through the material, that defense counsel acknowledged that they knew they were going to file an amended pleading to add the extra aggravating.
Yes.
And they said it twice in open court.
Yes.
And to me, it smacks of a waiver. I mean, if you're going to, there was no objection to it, obviously. And so, can you waive that requirement?
No. No, you can't. You can't change the rules of this court. You may recall that in Bennett, I believe, that the state tried to argue this court didn't even have the authority to come up with this rule. That's what they argued. Either Bennett or...
So I take it your argument would be that it would be pretty fundamental ineffective assistance of counsel to waive the notice of the death penalty.
Yes. You said what I should have said right now. Yes, it would be absolutely ineffective because it gets rid of the death penalty. It just finished. It saved the man's life. And how could he possibly have ignored that? Why would you waive it? It's clearly ineffective. As I stand here...
Or at a minimum, it would be ineffective counsel not to require the state to demonstrate what was the good cause for the delay because the burden's on the state. Is that your argument?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Could you shift gears to another subject?
Yes.
Order in this case was prepared by the state for the judge.
Yes.
And one of my colleagues and I were discussing this. Is there information in the record that provides direction for that order?
Nothing at all. In fact, we went into court. I remember the day we went into court. I could tell, as I have enough experience listening to district court judges, that based on what I was hearing, it sounded like I had lost the writ. But I remember there was almost no direction, and at the end, I quote myself as saying to the district court judge, writ denied, and the answer was yes. And I understood that. I just wanted to make sure that that's exactly what I was hearing. And really, there's just absolutely nothing in the record. And when what the state is arguing now is that they prepared the order and then submitted it to me. And I could make corrections. Well, then I don't permit my corrections, because my corrections are going to be I win, I've won, and that's just not the order of the court. So it's sort of silliness to say that I should have done something to give the direction. I don't know why the district court denied my writ. There was no real, any kind of philosophy or rationale given. The state just came up with what, essentially regurgitating what's in their brief. Alone.
How widespread is that practice?
Yeah. Do we have... Go ahead. I'm
sorry. I didn't mean to...
No, that's okay.
Justice Pickering, I have had lots of writs where the district court judge tells me why we're wrong or occasionally why we're right. Occasionally a writ is just denied. Sometimes the judges take it under advisement. I don't want to say it's widespread, although there may be, it may be happening. This one was particularly vague, but I can't say that I've seen it widespread. Usually in response to what I'm arguing in a courtroom, I get some feedback and have some knowledge of where my failures have been or where the success has been. Does that answer your question?
It does. I mean, there's a pretty outdated body of law, and I'm familiar with it only from the civil side, but that some courts historically would not give the same deference to findings of fact by a district court judge when those findings were embodied only in an order that was prepared by counsel and didn't tie to anything that the judge articulated as a basis for the ruling. And that always gives me a bit of pause when I have a record that's a cipher and then prepared findings. And I understand how busy everyone is, but it seems to me it's pretty momentous and deprives us of the benefit sometimes maybe of the district court's reasoning, which is always so helpful.
I'm sorry.
No, please go ahead.
What I was going to say also is the issue that we were discussing earlier, the 250 issue, you see, we have no feedback whatsoever on that, which would make the death penalty, make him actually innocent of the death penalty because there's no aggravating circumstances. And so, as you can see, the state would have absolutely raised that in their brief. This is what the reason of the court, there was no reason. And I see I'm very far out of time. If there are no further questions, I would like to still have the last
minute. I'll add 2 minutes to your time and 2 minutes to Mr. Owen's time as well. We took up a lot of your time.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County DA's office here on behalf of the state.
What say you to the notice of intent to seek the death penalty?
We have an evidentiary hearing. David Sheik, who in my experience is an attorney of integrity, he testified that he was on notice and had been on notice for a year about this other murder. We have two murder cases with Gregory Leonard. And they're kind of leapfrogging themselves in the system. There's an aggravator that we can allege prior conviction of a murder, but until we find out which case goes to trial and he gets convicted in first, we don't know where to allege that. And so it wasn't alleged in either case. And as Your Honor's pointed out, it's the same attorneys, prosecutor and defense on both cases, and they obviously had an understanding that whichever case we got the conviction on first, we would then go amend the death notice in the other case to allege the prior murder conviction. And that was the understanding of the parties here. I didn't do the evidentiary hearing. I wasn't there, but I read the transcripts. And my understanding of reading that record is that the prosecutor did not file the notice of amended notice to allege that aggravator until the day of trial, specifically because we had discussed it with defense counsel. If David Sheik had had any basis, any grounds to object, or if he had said, I'm going to object, we would have filed it within 15 days, but we had...
But again, that goes back to the issue of you can't waive that requirement, and prejudice isn't what we look at. We look at good cause, which wasn't set forth.
But sure, you can waive. You can waive constitutional rights. And here we're not even talking about the Constitution. We're talking about Rule 250.
And I think about it. If there's only one valid aggravator left, that keeps him death eligible, and if you object to the late notice and that aggravator could be stricken, then he's not death eligible.
I don't think reasonably competent counsel has to destroy their working relationship with the opposing counsel. There's all kinds of things like this that are discussed procedurally, little technical things. Agreements that are made that, hey, I'm going to follow this, I'm going to do this. And there's this understanding and a working relationship. And David Sheik isn't going to throw his reputation out the window and try to allege this. And if he had objected, I just can't envision any scenario under which the judge would have said, yeah, state, you're out of luck. The cases that I'm criticized for not citing, Bennett and Marshall, they were published in 2005 and 2000, respectively. This occurred in 1997. We can't judge David Sheik's conduct and performance based on case law that had not even been published yet. And Bennett and Marshall fundamentally changed everyone's understanding and interpretation of Rule 250. Nowadays,
did
absolutely.
Did Nevada in a singular position, Bennett and Marshall, in against the national landscape? Or do you know?
I'm sorry, I don't know. My position has always been Rule 250 is just that. It's a rule. It's a court rule. So long as we're complying with constitutional due process, the rules certainly shouldn't have the weight, I think, that Bennett and Marshall have given it.
Well, when you say in your brief, and Mr. Orme makes a fair point that the brief is quite cursory on this issue, when you say it would have been futile for Sheik to have amended or filed a motion to strike the amended notice of intent to seek death penalty. When you say that, what are you conveying? What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that in 1997, Rule 250 wasn't viewed the way it is today. Today, absolutely, we would not take any counsel's word for it. We would file that amended notice 15 days before. We would not miss that deadline, because if we did, we know that there's a strict interpretation of that rule, and we may not be able to get the good cause on in a motion. That was not the scenario in 1997. We can't judge Sheik's performance in hindsight based on how we do things today. 97, it was a whole lot looser with these procedures and their interpretation. If David Sheik had objected, I imagine Peggy Lee would have said, what are you talking about objected? You've known about this for a year. The understanding was we're simply talking about notice. Peggy Lee would say, I told you a year ago I'd be filing this amendment. How can you possibly object? And the trial judge, Michael Douglas, I'm sure, would have been saying, yeah, counsel, you knew about this for a year. How can you possibly willing to wait and object to something you knew the state was told you that it was going to be doing.
Okay, but Mr. Owens, what was the time between the other murder conviction and this filing on the EVA trial?
I think Mr. Owen had that, he said it was about a year, I think. Year and 2 months. I don't have the dates right handy in front of me. Certainly we knew, and we could have filed at any time. The fact that it was waited until the day of trial is because we had this understanding with David Sheik. David Sheik's a bright attorney. He's not going to miss an opportunity to deprive us of seeking the death penalty on a very strong aggravator. He just didn't think that he had any grounds to object to it, and certainly he was on notice. That was really the only basis in the interpretation of Rule 250, is if you didn't know about it, oh, this comes as a surprise. I'm not prepared for trial. Now I need a continuance. He didn't need a continuance.
But doesn't that go to the prejudice? Clearly there was a lack of prejudice because there was knowledge of this other, the other case and conviction. What's the good cause for just not filing the paper? Because did David Sheik say, hey, file it whenever you feel like it? Was that the conversation? Because I'm not finding that in the record.
I think the inference is that's exactly how I read it. It didn't come out exactly like that. David Sheik doesn't say, I told him you could file it whenever. But that's the inference that I get from reading that, is that there was this understanding between the two attorneys that we would be filing it, and that he would have no opposition. Now, yeah, that didn't come out, but that's my reading of it. And certainly that was consistent with how things were done back in 1997. I don't think it would have occurred to anyone to object
was
under Rule 250.
Was McConnell on the books in 97? It wasn't, right? McConnell was decided in early...
It was 04.
04. So this didn't acquire the significance...
We still had the one aggravator at the time, the robbery aggravator, so it was already a death case.
Not a home run hit.
After McConnell, now suddenly the murder is the only.
Yeah, you concede the robbery is off the table as the aggravator.
Right.
Yeah.
But again, that's the benefit of hindsight. That
Mr. Owens, I just had a question. I mean, and I understand 1997 being a district judge at the time, Michael Cherry was special public defender, so you worked with his office. Mr. Sheik was a deputy at that time, and I realize you worked together in a lot of these cases with the special public defender and the regular public defender on it as well. However, what's your response to what Mr. Worm said, that in these post-conviction proceedings on these time bars, we strictly hold these appellants or defendants accountable for these time bars here, and we're, it's not a level playing field when we don't hold the state responsible as well. And I realize you're giving your explanation what happened with Peggy Lane and all that, but philosophically, our duty is to treat everybody equally and all like that. How do we resolve that conundrum that Mr. Arms raised?
Because we have a body of case law that says the procedural bars are mandatory and they must be enforced, and if we don't, there's huge repercussions for us in the federal system. Mm-hmm. And so everyone's on notice that there's strict application of these bars. We still have good cause for successive and untimely petitions, but it's fairly narrow. Back in 97 with Rule 250, we didn't have this body of case law that said 15 days before trial, it can't be waived. I still disagree with that. I think it can be waived even today. We would need a better record than what we have here, but back in 97, I think the record is adequate. The burden is on him to show deficient performance and prejudice, and I think he's failed in both. Failed to show that David Sheik was deficient. It didn't occur to the district court judge, to the prosecutor, to David Sheik, that this 15-day rule was such a big deal. It is today, but not in 97.
Well, in 97, you still, as you said, had the robbery aggravator that you were relying on. This was just an addition to that.
Well, I mean, another aggravator, by the prior murder that everyone in the case knew was going to be there, that Sheik had been preparing for and ruled. That's how Rule 250 was interpreted back then. It's simply notice. Are you on notice? And David Sheik was, and so he's like, yeah, I've known about this. No objection, file that amended notice.
So if I understand your argument, you're suggesting that the record supports a conclusion by this court that Sheik was on actual notice if he was not on the notice provided under 250.
And he was on actual notice, and he was informed with the law in existence at the time, and that reasonable counsel would not have thought that they had grounds to object to adding an aggravator that they full well knew about and had been told about repeatedly by the prosecutor was going to be an issue in the case.
Does that distinguish Bennett and the other case that he cited? Had those cases been an actual notice?
I'm not sure about Marshall and Bennett. We definitely argued that's all it is actual notice, and this court disagreed and said, well, you still got to have a good cause. You got to.
Distinction.
Yeah, that's why I said Bennett changed the law. And if Bennett had been in existence at the time, then in 97, then maybe we'd have something to talk about. But Bennett, fundamentally, we were dumbfounded when this court decided Bennett. We were just befuddled that this court would not allow adding an aggravator in when they were on actual notice. Because of this, the untimeliness.
What would have the standards been to move for a continuance had this played out? State files written notice. Defense counsel says, no, you're too late. And they make the argument that Mr. Orm's making. Could the state at that point have said, and we need 30 days to restore this? And
I'm sure Mr. Piggy Wing would have been irate at David Sheik first for.
Take emotions out of it. Legally, what would have happened?
Certainly, if David Sheik had needed more time, he didn't. But if he needed more time, I'm sure Peggy Lean would have said,
take
more time.
It would be the state that needed more time. If Sheik had said, I object, this rule literally read applies, and you're taking unfair advantage, you're dead to rights here with this additional aggravator, and Justice Douglas, then Judge Douglas, had said, she's right, a literal reading of the rule, or defense counsel, he's right, a literal reading of the rule says you can't have this, then the state says, Peggy Lean says, okay, I move to continue for 30 days so I can file this timely. What would have been the standard applicable to that motion?
I'm not sure the prosecutor can get a continuance of the trial in order to come into conformity.
That's what I'm wondering.
With the rule, the defense attorney certainly could have. I don't know that the prosecutor could have.
That's the consequence of the Bennett holding. On its face. The rule talks about the defense being able to get a continuance, which makes sense, but the prosecutor who messes up is dead to rights, is what you're saying?
Unless they have good cause, and this court has taken a narrow view of that. If we, if we were aware of the aggravator previously and didn't file it within the time period, then there's no good cause.
And a continuance to reset the calendar clock, the 15-day clock running, is not something the state can or would seek.
And the trial would have to be continued for some other reason, I think, unrelated to this. We would have problems with this under Bennett if it happened today, but Bennett can change the law, and we shouldn't hold Sheik accountable to that.
Do you have a Polk problem with the Bennett analysis that you're tendering now, in as much as this wasn't really argued in the answering brief? I think that's what Mr. Orm is suggesting, and I'll just put it
blankly. We got a pretty fat answering brief. I didn't go back and look to make sure that we did justice to this argument. We did cite the one case that Your Honor's already pointed out from
1985,
and it may not have been a 250 case, but at least it was in existence and something that David Sheik would have been aware of and possibly relied upon in thinking that he had no basis to object. But concession of error, a failure to adequately brief it, I don't think so. I think it's obviously apparent that both of us had to cut our briefs down. I think Mr. Orm had to cut his down considerably more. There's a number of issues where he's given us one short paragraph and incorporated by reference to the lengthy, voluminous habeas petition down below, and we took him to task for that. Both parties had to narrow this down quite a bit.
I think he wanted a 300-page brief or something, which would be...
We certainly intentionally haven't tried to leave out anything of significance. In hindsight, it seems real juicy here to be able to say, hey, we get rid of this aggravator, it's no longer a death case. But I think if you remove the distorting effects of hindsight and judge it based on the circumstances at the time and the parties involved in the law in existence, I don't think it was deficient performance. Let me shift real quickly to the other issue Mr. Orm raised, I believe Justice Hardesty did, regarding the findings. I would love to be out of the business of drafting findings for the district court judges. It takes up a great deal of our time, even if it is mostly a cut-and-paste job from our briefs. And I know that we've gone back and forth with the issue of findings in this court, and we don't necessarily agree. I've been a proponent saying that the findings aren't all that important. It's, yes, it's desirable to have findings as an appellate body. Is it indispensable? Is it a reversible error not to have these detailed findings from the judge? And I don't think so. Just like the jury is a finding of fact, and they don't give us detailed versions of what they were thinking, we construe the facts in a way consistent with their verdict. And we do so with the district court judge here, who had this voluminous habeas petition. And yeah, we didn't get any guidance. I admit that. We did not. The judge said, well, I've been working on this for a couple months. I got 13 pages. I never saw those 13 pages. The judge said, go ahead and draft up the findings. So we pretty much cut and pasted from our briefs. Excuse me, which I think is appropriate given the lack of guidance. What else are we going to do? It's assumed that the judge is going to resolve any issues in our favor. She made the ultimate finding that state you win. Mr. Arnold, right, the writ is denied. State you win. State you dropped up the findings. Share them with Mr. Arnold. And I'm sorry, Mr. Arnold had the opportunity to submit findings. The judge even said that. Mr. Arnold, look at that. Submit your own findings. The judge could have had two sets of findings. It could have said any, meeny, miny, mo. Or mix the two together and come up with your own findings.
Does that affect the deferential standard of review with respect to contested issues, the fact that you think it should or shouldn't? Obviously, you're going to say it should not.
I don't think it should affect this case. If you want to get after the district court judges and have them do findings on their own, they do have law clerks from all in favor of that. There's a few that do that, or in select cases that they will do that. I'd love to see more of that. I don't think it should affect the outcome of this appeal. I don't think it changes the analysis. Maybe there's a little, slightly less deferential burden because the judge did not author them. She obviously agreed with them because she read them and signed them. But there was an evidentiary hearing. To the extent that there was disputes of fact, we can infer that the judge resolved those in the state's favor at the fact finding.
Our judges they have so much work. I mean, that's part of the problem with this area.
Petition this big, the findings, you know, I don't remember how long these were, but
25 pages.
Yeah, they're pretty substantial, and it takes one of our law clerks a great deal of time away from when they could be working on a brief such as.
I would like to. I smiled when you raised this issue. I think getting the DA's office out of this and having the judge write their orders is the better practice. Raises a question as to whether this court should require that. But apart from that point, one of the things that concern me is the very issue we've been talking about. What was the record with respect to Sheik's position on the notice? And that isn't addressed in these findings and conclusions. And so I'm concerned that we are reviewing an order that addresses a pretty critical question that we've been discussing. Judge Givens has some acquaintance with the practice in the 8th Judicial District Court because he was a judge here, but that's not in the record. The fact that Justice Cherry was in the special prosecutor, special defense, public defense, that's not in the record. The record that's in front of us is the record that was made and the order that was entered. And it appears to me, unless I'm missing something, that the point that we've been debating in the majority of this oral argument today isn't confronted in this order. And to that extent, I think these orders are very critical. And none of that's really developed in the order. It's one of the more important issues on the claims for relief. Am I missing something? Is there something in the order here, Mr. Owens, that would cover this point?
Well, we have the transcript of the evidence from hearing.
Right.
And we have the fact that the cases Mr. Owens is relying upon to show that Sheik was ineffective weren't even in existence at the time. And we've got the testimony from David Sheik that says, I knew all along that there was going to be this aggravator.
Yeah. What I'm uneasy about is there's no record. This case, as a death penalty case, if we were to affirm it, is going to be reviewed by at least one other court, potentially, other federal courts. And they're going to be asking the same question that I'm posing today, I think, which is, you're talking about all this practice that existed in 97, and none of that's discussed in this record. It isn't even discussed, frankly, in the evidentiary hearing.
As a failure of Mr. Leonard, who carries the burden of proof to elicit the facts to establish the claim that this was deficient performance under the law in existence at the time. Mm-hmm. To the extent those questions were not asked of David Sheep and the record was not developed, then that's a failure on the defense side, and this court should be comfortable affirming. Like, there's enough here to read between the lines to understand what was going on. It would have been better if there had been more detailed questions asked. But it is what it is, and the 7-inch hearing went on for several days, and they touched on a lot of different issues, and trying to ascertain some years later what is going to be the one big issue on appeal that everyone's going to be asking about. I mean, I prepped both this case and the one yesterday. I prepped for tens of thousands of pages and all kinds of issues, and trying to figure out which is the one that's going to be the one that they're really focusing on. It's a guessing game.
Oh, sure. Well, I wish we would go back to inserting in our notices of oral argument some alert to counsel so that you all have a better opportunity to know what is of interest to the court. Maybe we'll get that rule revisited.
That is helpful. We both able to do that. I think I'm out of time, right?
You are.
Okay, thank you.
Very much. And Mr. Oram, I want to give you the same amount of additional time. So, Madam Clerk, please, I had given him 2 extra minutes, which we had given State's counsel, but then State had another 3 minutes. So could you please give Mr. Oram 5 minutes and 55 seconds? You may not need it all, but I want to be even-handed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Should I start? I can see the clock is not starting.
Just 1 sec, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, proceed. To answer the question about what did David Sheep say at the evidentiary hearing, I was there, and I quoted it, and I'm going to quote it. Just so what I heard right now from the state was a whole bunch of conjecture about conversations that I don't know anywhere in the record where they came from. Well, you know, now Judge Lane must have said this to Mr. Sheep, and they all high-fived, and they all knew. Let's look at what's in the record. Mr. Sheep swore under oath, and this is from page 9 of my reply brief, indented paragraph at the bottom, I did not have a strategic justification for not raising a motion to strike the state's notice of additional aggravating circumstances as untimely filed. I believe that such a motion could have been successful because the state would not have been able to demonstrate good cause for its failure to file the notice for the year and a half between the conclusion of the Thomas Williams trial and the start of the third Antee trial. On the witness stand, I asked Mr. Sheik, is everything in your affidavit accurate? Have you reviewed it? Yes. That's what his position was. Not that I wouldn't raise this because this would be really offensive to my friend who told me about this, and we were all under, she was going to file 30 days beforehand. I thought, don't bother. There's none of that in
there. Well, Mr. Orme, at the evidentiary hearing, and we'll look at it again, the transcript, but was there any testimony, as Mr. Owens alluded to, that there were conversations between Peggy Lean and David Sheik about this other case, and they were going to seek to add that as an aggravator after that murder conviction?
What I can tell you in favor of the state is that Mr. Sheik did say, I knew about this. There was no, so if the state wants to say he was on notice, I believe that's clearly in the record. With regard to your specific question, were there conversations? In other words, I talked to Judge Lean about this. Are there? I don't want to say no and then have you find it. This record was very large. I can't accurately answer that question, although I put in the brief what I thought was important, that there was no strategic reason for not filing it. And obviously, if the state had something explaining that away, we would have seen it. Instead of just conjecture today about what conversations that allegedly occurred. And now I realize, I almost want to put Mr. Owens on notice that I would be filing timely notices of appeal and writs of habeas corpus on every single case. And from now on, then I'll never have to worry about timeliness issues because he's on notice that I'm going to do that.
Mr. Moon, it seems that the trial, and correct me if I'm wrong, the trial court was viewing us through the lens of prejudice and not through good cause. It seems the record's devoid of a good cause analysis, but that's just...
That's right. I think that there was oftentimes the thought of prejudice, and because the state argued that in both Marshall and Bennett extensively, that there's no prejudice. And not only did they do it here, another case that I argued, before the court unbound was application of State versus Kinney. And again, the state claimed at the time that, oh, they knew of the notice of intent on, even though they filed it on the day of the first day of trial. They were just getting away with this. And when I hear the prosecution say there is no body of law at the time, there's a rule. The rule is self-explanatory. It is not ambiguous. I don't know why the state thinks, well, since there's no body of law, do we really need to follow what the Supreme Court rule says? As a practitioner before this court, I would suggest it's a really good idea. I mean, if I was instructing a young attorney, I'd be like, follow the rule. Follow the rule precisely. Don't just ignore it with the idea that I could come before this court saying I told them, you know, in a casual conversation somewhere.
Well, now, about following rules, what about NRAP 28 and all the incorporation without requesting leave of the court to file an extended brief? Why should we consider those incorporations?
I have pulled that out this morning, and I looked. With regard to argument 7 and 7, I noticed that I said incorporate, but then I provide 23 pages to support it. And then I am saying, yes, could you please look in the record. In argument 8, I do the same thing with a brief summary of the issue and citations to case law. Same with arguments 9 and 10. Argument 11, I did use incorporation, but cited numerous cases and wrote nearly 5 pages. Argument 12, the same as 8 through 10. I could go through this, and they cite to Thomas, where all he did was say, attached to the supplemental petition, spelling out witnesses that should have been called, and that's what he did. I tried to incorporate what I could. This court is very strict about rules of page limit. I had difficulty trying to pare this down. And so I recognize that I have, at least this brief may not be in perfect conformance with what this court expects. And so
I want to return to the argument on Bennett and Marshall and the lay of the law when in 1998 or 97 this case went to trial. McConnell was not on the books. 250 was, but Marshall hadn't been handed down, and it was 5 years after Marshall that Bennett came down. What lens do we look at? We look at this through what it looked like in 1997 or 98 when this case went to trial, not with the benefit of hindsight. Is that, you would agree with me on that?
In part, I would agree with you. Yes, those cases were not in existence, but why would this court's decision be any different
than what the rule says?
And also, Marshall and Bennett, when they came up, these are the same arguments being extended by the state, and this court frowned upon the state's arguments. I don't see how, if this issue come up, the difference in the name, Leonard versus Bennett.
Leonard would have been the first.
Yes.
He would have been Marshall rather than Marshall.
And the lens of 1997 and the performance of counsel should be viewed based upon what the record shows the lens to be, not what we might suggest it or speculate it might have been.
Correct. The record is, and the evidentiary hearing is, and the affidavit is what is in the record, and I rely upon that, Your Honor.
And what is, I know we're past time, but what does that show? Your opposing colleague says that's on you to have made the showing that it was deficient in 97. So you have Mr. Sheik's admission, which you read to us, that there was no strategic reason for that. Is there anything else?
No. And I see my time's done.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I want to thank both lawyers for their arguments in this case, and we will stand briefly submitted while we reconstitute the court. So this matter will be under submission and will be in adjournment just momentarily.